Listeners supported KTOO. Welcome to Juno Afternoon, broadcasting live from the homelands of the Occoquan and on demand as a podcast. It's Thursday, May 28th, 2026. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Gunath Chi, Shawa, Toksknusum, Salamat. Thank you for joining the conversation. You may also join us on our live stream on KTOO's YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram pages. Today, author Rachel Weaver has a new book, The Last Run, about a mother fighting to save her family legacy and her son. It's coming to terms with her past. We'll talk with Rachel about this new book. Celebration is the biennial dance and cultural event and largest gathering of Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian in the world. And there are two canoe landings that take place earlier in the week before Celebration begins. Tlingit and Haida's Alicia Sell is here to share more about the Occoquan landing happening next Tuesday, June 2nd. And UAS Outdoor Studies program shares about its Salmon, Sport, and Society program, plus more. Those conversations are coming up this hour on Juno Afternoon. Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Tongass Federal Credit Union, a member-owned financial cooperative offering checking and savings accounts, loans, and digital financial services. In Juno at 8585 Old Dairy Road in the K Plaza and at tongassfcu.com, federally insured by NCUA. Something really cool, Sea Stories Live 2026. It's returning to downtown Juno for an unforgettable evening of youth storytelling. It's on June 2nd. That's next Tuesday from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. It's going to be at the Aurora Grand Theater. It's storytelling, film, music, community connection. Audiences will experience powerful student-created films from young storytellers across Southeast Alaska. You get to hear directly from the youth filmmakers. You're going to enjoy a community silent auction and all kinds of stuff, plus live music from local musician Quentin Woolman Morgan. Sea Stories is an Alaska-based nonprofit dedicated to building inclusive communities through film and storytelling, through documentary film, podcasting, media workshops, and more. So that's all next week, Tuesday, June 2nd, 6:30 to 8:30 at the Aurora Grand Theater.
You're listening to KTOO's Tlingit Word of the Week. This week's word comes from Kakwan Ish George Davis. And the word this week is Atanhiddi.
Atanhiddi.
That means smokehouse. And here is a sentence.
Atanhiddi chasayati duchad.
He hung his fish in the smokehouse. Let's hear it again.
Atanhiddi.
Smokehouse. Gunas Chish to Hune Lance Twitchell, Gold Belt Heritage Foundation, and the University of Alaska for this audio.
Kahuan Ish, George Davis was Tukdain Tan and the child of a Tsagwe Di man. He grew up in Qiq, Cake, Alaska, and learned to speak well because he would always bring traditional foods to the elders there. As someone who fished a lot and spent time on the land, he knew Tlingit place names all over the area, and he learned many stories and advanced ways of speaking.
And tune in next week for another Tlingit Word of the Week from KTOO.
You are listening to community-supported Juno Afternoon on KTOO at 104.3 Juno, 91.7 Juno Ok Bay, and online at ktoo.org. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Described by fellow author Tiffany K. Tyson, The Last Run is thrilling, a propulsive adventure story about a mother fighting to save her family legacy and her son, all while covered in fish guts, battling Alaska storms, outwitting dangerous men, and coming to terms with her past. I think there's some secrets maybe in there. Rachel Weaver's Alaska is beautiful and punishing, and her stories make me want to chuck my phone in the trash and go fishing. Can't wait for the next one. Tiffany K. Tyson is the author of The Past Is Never. And I am pleased now to welcome Rachel Weaver to the studio here at KTOO. Gunath Chi, Sha'iguddi, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to have you here. Wasiati, how are you today, Rachel?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Of course. So you lived in Alaska a couple decades ago, yeah? So describe your time in Alaska here before you had to, you know, go elsewhere.
My first season in Alaska, I was working on one of the smaller cruise ships. I mostly wanted to travel around Alaska, but had $0, so I had to get a job doing that. So I'd never seen, you know, glaciers or whales or been in a sea kayak, but I told the guy I had really good balance, and he hired me to be a kayak guide on one of what is now the uncruised boats, but back then they were owned by another company. So I worked on that boat that came through Juneau every 6 days, picked up passengers. And then the next season, I applied for four service jobs and ended up in Petersburg for the next number of years.
Oh, wow. Okay. And where did you grow up?
I grew up outside Nashville.
Outside Nashville. Okay. And so what was the call to Alaska? How did you decide that this was a place that you felt like you wanted to come to?
My dad was a big adventurer, so I grew up hearing lots of stories of his adventures. And when I was 19, I had $80, and I thought, well, I'll probably make it to Colorado. and I didn't. I made it to Nebraska, and my Uncle Willie, well, he made me work for a day, and then he gave me $20 and filled up my gas tank, and I made it the rest of the way to Colorado. So I lived in Colorado for a couple years, and then I worked in Wyoming in the Tetons for another couple or maybe a year or so, and then sort of the next logical step, wilder place, was Alaska.
That's so funny. Well, and speaking of fathers, this book, The Last Run, has an interesting story to it. It's about a daughter and a mother who, well, you tell me a little bit about this plot. Like, how does it begin? What happens at the beginning of this story?
So the main character is Ellie. She is a young single mom. Her son is five, well, almost five when the book opens. And she grew up fishing with her parents. Her mom died when she was a teenager, and she and her dad became estranged. Lots of things happened that she felt were irreconcilable. So she leaves and has this baby, you know, meets the wrong guy, has the baby on her own. She is really struggling to make ends meet as a single mom. She's living in a fictionalized Petersburg in the book. Mm-hmm. And she hasn't seen her dad in 7 years. And the book opens when she's walking her son to daycare, and she looks up the alley behind the bar, which happens to be the Harbor Bar. but I called it something else in the book. And sees him beat up in the, like, behind the bar alley. And everything sort of progresses from there. It turns out he has a gambling problem, which she did know that, but he has gambled away the boat and the permit, which she always imagined would be hers one day. And the bookie has given him the season to fish to try to make the money back, plus a big chunk of interest. But the bookie,
bookie's with that interest.
I know, you know, always. I know.
The big.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. So the bookie has his own kind of nefarious plan underway that they don't know about. There's lots of secrets in the book. Everybody's keeping a secret from everybody else.
Yeah, the reveals are pretty cool. And it's kind of interesting when you get to the end. And I can see where Tiffany, your author friend, says, can't wait for the next one. So are you planning to tell another story after this one?
Not a sequel.
I
do not have a sequel planned.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Mm-mm. Interesting. Okay. I love that then. That's kind of cool. And so when you were writing to me about this, you told me a little anecdote about how long this book took for you to mm-hmm. get done. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So when I was living in Petersburg, I was living there year-round, and I spent too much time in the bar the first couple winters. And so I thought, well, I need a hobby of some sort. And I thought, well, I'll just write a book. That sounds fun and maybe not that hard. And so I started writing a book. I was a big reader, but I never studied, you know, I had never tried to write a book. I hadn't really, you know, studied English aside from just the required courses. And I started writing a book, and it was like the most fantastic thing ever. And one night in the bar, I was sitting across from my friend Diane, and I was like, I don't know what's wrong with these people. It takes them 10 years to write a book. I'm going to be done in like 6 months. And I was done in 6 months. I wrote a first draft. And then I went, you know, the season started. I got really busy. I didn't look at it until the next winter. But I was pretty convinced that whole time that I'd written like the greatest book ever. And then I reread it after not looking at it for a number of months, and I realized that I'd actually written like the worst book ever.
Oh, no.
But I was really interested in how, like the puzzle of it, like how do people write books that have impacted me so much, and how do they craft these characters that I can remember for years or decades. And so it just became this, you know, puzzle that I was so interested in trying to solve and make the book better.
What was the thing that you made you think this was the worst book ever? When you went back to it, why was it the worst book ever?
Well, it didn't really have a plot. It just was like a whole bunch of random stuff that happened, right? There wasn't enough cause and effect. There wasn't enough tension. I just was pretty, like, interested in these characters, so it was just basically like 300 pages of character study.
I see. Okay.
Yeah,
which is valid in some ways, but you got to keep it moving, I guess.
Well, yeah, that's a first draft, right? What I didn't realize is that you do that first, but then you have to layer in all the other stuff. But I started to realize that, and I started trying to do that. But the book was so broken, I think it was very overwhelming to try to fix it. So when I left Alaska, I went to grad school in writing and found an agent to represent it. She tried selling it in that sort of – I made it a little better through grad school, but it still wasn't great. She tried to sell it, couldn't sell it. And in the meantime, I wrote and published two other books, but I kept coming back to this one because I kept – I don't like things to be left undone, so I just kept coming back and trying to fix it and trying to fix it, and I would take years off and then go back into it. So I've written – this book has been like 20 other books, but I did finish it finally 20 years later.
That is – awesome. That it's 20 years?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So it was gestating for a while.
Yeah.
I love that. Does it feel satisfying to have this story complete now?
It does. It feels a little confusing, actually, over the past week or so.
You're like, where's that monkey that I knew had there for all that time?
Exactly. And because I knew I was going to talk to you, I was like, I better read that thing. Because in my mind, it's still all the different drafts that it's ever been.
Sure.
Right? So there's still a little uncertainty as to what exactly landed in there and what was taken out.
It's interesting because I think like if you have an event or something and you have like a Q&A and people have read it and they'd be like, well, why did Ellie do this and why? And you're like, yeah, was that in that? Was that? What happened? Okay. But then you answer it with something that's not in there anymore.
Yeah, so, no good.
You got to know. That's pretty cool. Because that was my other question, was the idea about like how do you get as an independent author, there's a ton of people who write books and other things here in Juneau. We were talking about that yesterday with the poets that are in town. And just the idea of, like, how do you get that next step? And it sounds like you had sort of a traditional path where you found you were able to – lucky enough, as they say, to get an agent who believed in your writing. And then you mentioned you wrote a couple things before this book came out. So,
I did.
And was that something that – was done after you had that agent, you started writing those other books?
Oh, yeah. That first agent ditched me pretty quick after she couldn't sell the book.
I see.
So it's been a long road, but I mean, I did go to graduate school. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I just, you know, I knew what my weaknesses were, which were predominantly plot related. So mm-hmm. then I spent like 7 years reading extremely plotted books to be like, how do they do it? And I would outline, you know, after I finished the book, I'd be like, all right, this happened, then this happened, then this happened. And I started to recognize sort of the elements of what makes a good plot or mm. books. It was really helpful, actually, just to pick random books from the library shelf, because then I would end up with books, a lot of books that I didn't like. And it's a lot easier to figure out what goes wrong in a book that you don't like than how someone crafted, you know, this perfect book that you love. Mm. So I just have always been pretty self-directed in my studies of what I know to be some of my weaknesses as a writer. And then I continue to take classes at a literary center in Denver. Now that's a lot easier because they're online. There's lots of online classes you can take.
And you're a mentor now to writers as well, right?
Yes, I work for one of the literary centers in Denver, the literary center in Denver, Lighthouse Writers Workshop. I teach in their two-year program, and then I also teach in an MFA program on the East Coast in their low-residency MFA program.
I see. Now, this book, The Last Run, is set here in Alaska in a sort of made-up idea of Petersburg, like
True.
You mentioned. Are your other books having to do with Alaska as well?
Yes. The first one I wrote is called Point of Direction. It takes place at Eldred Rock Lighthouse.
Oh, yeah.
Which I just heard is opening to the public mm-hmm. June 1st. That's mm-hmm. so exciting. So that one is a fictionalized version of the lighthouse. And then the second one is a nonfiction book. It just came out in February, actually.
Oh, what's that about?
That one is a braided memoir of my time, my misadventures and adventures here in Alaska. Working for the Forest Service, and my long journey as a person with a mysterious chronic illness that no one could figure out, and I was bounced around between about 50 doctors.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, so that one has a lot to do with power dynamics in different settings. Yeah.
Cool. And yeah. you have your own website, rachelweaver.net. Where you can find out more about Rachel's work and order the book. I'm sure it's available online as well. I know Hearthside's going to eventually have some copies. The book actually doesn't release until this one, The Last Run. It comes out, was it June 9th, you said?
Yep, that one comes out June 9th, but Hearthside should have copies next week.
Yeah, that would be great. And a little preview. So my last question for you before we got to go is, it's interesting because you were here for, I don't know how many years you were here for, but it seems like it does to a lot of people, Alaska sort of has invaded your soul.
It did, yes.
Yeah, and yes. because you're writing about it, and and although you can't, have you ever thought about coming back?
Oh, definitely. My medical odyssey kept me out of Southeast Alaska for 18 years. I was still, you know, in the realm of specialist after specialist after specialist. And it's just in the last 2 years that it has been resolved.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. So, yes, I do definitely hope to get back up here.
Well,
eventually.
Stop writing about it and come back.
I know.
because this is a really cool novel. It's kind of a... I don't know what if you had to genre it, what would you say? It is a character study. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that goes on in this book. There's like, and like you said, there's a bunch of secrets and there's a lot of things that go on. And it's like Ellie has challenges, and of course, having a 5-year-old brings its own sense of challenges. But the boy gets involved in the fishing and sort of really takes to it and sort of gets exposed to that lifestyle, right? In terms of getting out on the water and fishing and all that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so, but it's got some drama, you know, there's definitely some drama in there,
yeah.
and like choices that have to be made.
Yeah.
And, but I wouldn't say it's a thriller.
No,
not a thriller.
No, I think, well, the powers that be in the publishing world call it a family drama.
Family drama.
Because okay. it is centered around the relationship between all the characters, but then is typically described as, you know, with elements of mystery and adventure, and, you know.
Is your dad still with us?
No, he is
oh,
not.
Oh, I was going to say, what would he, did he read it at some point?
No, I lost him as a teenager, the same as
oh.
the character loses her mom.
I see. Okay. Because
yep.
I was going to say, like, it's really interesting to think about, you know, like what kind of personal experience you're putting into the book in terms of like making dad a character and like that relationship with the lead character and all the things they go through and not being able to connect with then connecting and, you know, all those kinds of things. Love is very powerful.
It is, yes.
Love is very powerful, and family is there's a strength in family that sometimes, you know, it overpowers everything.
True.
Yeah, it's very cool. Rachel Weaver, The Last Run, a new novel, comes out June 9th. Hearthside will have some copies, knock on wood, next week here in Juneau, so you can pick that up. You can go to rachelweaver.net for more information on Rachel and her past books. I'm really curious about now about your nonfiction book and your journey with your health, because that's always very fascinating, like the fact that people couldn't identify or, you know, that you bounced around between 50 doctors and stuff. That's just, that's got to be frustrating, but also like at least it has finally gotten to a place where you feel, you know, better.
Yeah, no, all better.
Yeah,
that's fabulous.
That's that's great. Yeah. Well, thanks for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
That's Rachel Weaver, everybody. This is Juneau Afternoon on KTOO.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. On many farms, honeybees buzz about, pollinating berry bushes, nut trees, and melon vines. Without these tiny insect farm workers, many of these crops would never reach grocery shelves. But Jun Chin, a researcher at Texas A&M Kingsville, warns that as the climate warms, honeybees could face trouble. The young bees in honeybee broods fare best when their hives stay between roughly 92 and 96 degrees.
Above or below this range, it will be dangerous for that brood.
On hot days, honeybees have a few methods to cool the hive, like spritzing water through the colony and fanning their wings to ventilate the air. But if it gets too hot, those strategies might not be enough.
Extreme heat waves may challenge the natural cooling systems of the honeybee colonies.
In a recent study of hives in Arizona, Chen found that higher temperatures were linked to adult bee population drops, and big temperature swings were linked to both brood and adult bee declines. She says farmers can help bees stay cool by keeping hives in the shade, misting them, and providing water nearby. But as the climate warms, it may become harder to keep these pollinators safe. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Support from Hanson Gress. Seeking curious people who like technology, network engineering, and customer support. Opportunities for those who thrive on problem solving. Details at hansongress.com/careers.
Afternoon from your listener-supported public media station, KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Next Tuesday, June 2nd at 1 p.m., community members are encouraged to join Akwan in welcoming canoes ashore and celebrating the cultural traditions, strength, and unity represented through the canoe journey. It's all a precursor to celebration, the biennial dance and cultural event honoring the indigenous tribes of Southeast. And Klikit and Haida's Alicia Sell is here to share about this event and how you can participate. Gunath Chish, Ha'igudi, thank you so much for being here today, Alicia. It's a pleasure. Wasiti, how are you today?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having us. I appreciate you giving us the opportunity to come and let everybody know what's going on and what to expect for next Tuesday.
So. Yeah, it's really, it's always fun to, I remember going to the one out at Rock Rec when the Hawaiian journey was coming through.
Hukulea.
And there was like, I mean, I don't know how many people were out there, but there was a lot of people. That was like 1,200 people at least or something.
That's
it was huge. So this is the biennial celebration. There's going to be two. Obviously, there's another canoe landing that happens downtown.
Correct.
But this one, Tlingit and Haida is helping out with. Tell me how you all are involved in this particular canoe landing.
Yeah. So for me specifically, I work with our public safety division. And so our public safety division has kind of been running the planning and organization of the whole event. So because it's a very well-attended event, there's usually quite a few hundred people out there. Mm. It takes some organization to make sure that everybody is safe, everybody has access, the roadways are not blocked up, all of the different behind-the-scenes thoughts that have to go into planning for the event for that. So that's been kind of my job this year, is been running all of the organization and planning for the event leading up to it. So
awesome. Yeah. And we'll get into some of those details here. And I just wanted to ask this question too. Like, everyone is welcome to this.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And you want people to come and celebrate this. And I think there's going to be, is it 13? Canoes that are going to be landing?
That's our current estimate, is 13 canoes and up to 160 paddlers.
Wow.
On board those canoes as they're coming into shore. So, so the canoes are going to be planning to land on the beach at about 1 p.m. They will be greeted by the clan leaders for both the Eagle and the Raven houses that support the areas out there. They'll have dance groups that are going to welcome the canoes in. There's going to be just a lot of just amazing, really phenomenal celebration. Just the regalia that's out there is just always awesome to see, the dancing, the drumming, just, you know, it really kind of brings you back to where this land truly actually came from and the people that have helped keep it where it's at and what it means to them is still in their hearts and still in their souls.
Yeah, and the call and response and the welcoming and it's such a great thing to witness.
Yes.
And to sort of think about, like, past, right? Mm-hmm. Before we all had our phones and all this other stuff, but like even the communication available, like, mm-hmm. Just to have people traveling through Southeast and arriving to the shore and being welcomed and, you know, figuring out whether it's friend or foe or why you're here and what's going on.
Yeah.
Are you bringing us stuff? Are you trying to attack
Take
us
over?
Or what's going on?
Who are you?
Yeah,
what do
who
you
are
want?
You and why do you want? Why do you want to come here? And
yes.
And so that's really kind of fun to sort of witness that.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I can't imagine what the regalia game is going to be like.
Yeah, it's always very impressive to see. So it's always one of my favorite parts about this this event and just in general. And then also a celebration, of course, as well. The grand entrance, the regalia that comes in, not just from the Tlingit, the Haida, and the Tsimshians, but there are other tribes that also come to join in now as well. It's really interesting. My heritage is actually from the Aleuts, from the Unalaska chain area. So,
oh, nice.
It's kind of interesting because every once in a while I will see Unagan people. We actually had an Unagan canoe that joined last year's celebration landing or canoe landing. And that was really, I didn't know that was coming in. So
you
to
didn't
see
know.
That gentleman
so
coming
fun.
In on an Aleut canoe was just, it was really, really interesting to see that. So
yeah, that's very cool.
Yeah.
I love that. And of course, one thing that we want to mention is that, you know, there's a lot of, like you said, there's safety issues here,
mm-hmm.
in terms of parking and how you get there, making space for the elders.
Mm-hmm.
So let's go over some of that stuff. What do we need to talk about there?
I appreciate that. So this year we have added an extra bus from 2 years ago. We had two buses that were offering shuttle service. This year we have three. Thank you to Gold Belt Heritage. They're donating their buses and their drivers for the day for shuttle service between the UAS main campus parking lot and out to the scene out at Dock Rec.
Oh, cool.
We also have partnered with First Student, and we will be having an ADA transport van available as well.
Oh, nice.
So those that are ADA needed transport, we will also have an ADA transport van available for shuttle service between UAS and Dock Rec. We're hoping to try to limit as much parking as we can on site because it's very, very limited parking out there.
So you want that to be more for like elders and people who maybe need that a little bit more.
Yeah.
So people would be parking at the university, right?
Correct. Yeah,
and
the main campus
the
parking
big,
lot.
The main campus parking lot, mm-hmm. and then shuttling over.
Yep.
And partaking in that. And do you recommend how early people? I know it says 10 to 2 the shuttle will be running.
That's actually going to be 11 to 3.
Oh, 11 to 3. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So. 11 to 3.
11 to 3, the shuttle service will be running. The canoes are planning to land at 1 p.m., so that we're starting the shuttles 2 hours prior to give people enough time to get out there, get set up, you know, find their favorite spot, and so on. We'll also have some of the youth group that are going to be volunteering to help escort some of the elders and the disabled individuals that need help. Mm-hmm. We'll have some people to be able to help them down either the ramp or the stairs, depending on their capabilities on the day of the event. And then after the event is done, the shuttle service back up to UAS to go back to their vehicles, so that way we're not having as many cars down at the site.
And you do you're also recommending that people maybe bring their own camping chair or something
yes.
to sit on. If you need something to sit on,
yes,
like you can put it on your back or bring it on the bus with you, something that's able to be seated. And then also don't forget to bring some water.
Yes. Huge shout out to the Weather Service. I have some good friends over there that we partner with for other things. And they are looking like they're forecasting some really amazing weather for us on Tuesday.
Oh, nice.
So it's looking like the last time I looked, it was sunshine and 70 is the current
what?
Forecast for Tuesday. So, yeah, huge shout out to the Weather Service. I appreciate them bringing in the good weather for us.
That's so cool.
So also bring their sunscreen, potentially.
Can you imagine? I mean, I guess we do need sunscreen sometimes in Juneau.
You know, well, after the winter and the spring that we have had, I think a lot of us are looking a little more pale than normal. So,
yeah.
You know, once we get the good few sunshiny days for the first times in the year, it kind of takes over from it. So
I like to say is we need that vitamin D.
Yes.
You know, we need that and a little more sun on our lot and in our eyes. Yeah, it's so
yes.
nice. And so I wanted to make sure we also mentioned that you have goes without saying, but just in terms of respecting the land, mm-hmm. And taking care of the area, don't leave your stuff behind. Oh, don't leave trash behind.
Please don't.
you know, I feel like Juneau is pretty good about that overall. I think the people here are pretty solid. But when you get to large events like that
yeah.
with hundreds or potentially 1,000 people,
yeah.
sometimes people forget or, you know, it just gets a little messy.
It can. Thankfully, some of our other departments, our procurement team is going to bring out extra trash cans because obviously just a couple of little trash cans that Forest Service has on scene out there, those would get very full very quick. So we will have staff out there with extra trash cans and patrolling to make sure that we do clean up because absolutely we don't want to leave anything behind. We don't want to damage the area. You know, we're here honoring our ancestry and our heritage and the land that has allowed us to live here for time immemorial. So we want to make sure that we're definitely, you know, respecting it and cleaning up after yourself. So if you see something, pick it up, even if it's not yours, please.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense.
Simple things.
You were talking about how sort of your heritage is a little bit more up north, but like being able to see it here. What kind of things happen up north that are similar to this? Is there something that happens that's similar to this kind of event?
I'm actually, unfortunately, not sure. So my heritage is from Unalaska, but I've never actually been there myself.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And kind of my little Cliff's Notes version of me is my grandmother and my great aunt were actually separated during the Japanese invasion when that was going on through the Aleutian chains.
Yeah.
And so my grandmother actually never embraced her heritage, and it was after her passing that my mother was actually able to go back and find out which tribal membership we should have been a part of, and was able to recreate our heritage.
Oh, nice.
So then I was able to. So now I'm a tribal member of the Kowalungan tribe of Unalaska.
Unalaska. Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
And then about a year or so ago, I was actually honored with a Unagic name from one of my coworkers at Klinken and Haida, which was super, super awesome.
What is that?
So my Unagin name is Ilagunas Nikax,
nice.
Which translates into one who helps.
Oh, that's so sweet.
So my day-to-day job, I mostly teach CPR first aid. CERT, or a community emergency response team, fire safety classes, things like that. And I take that out to a lot of our very small, very rural communities. So he was honored me with that name based off of what I do and what I've been doing for my life. So
I love that. Do you have a personal goal to make it there sometime?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
My family still owns property in Onalaska, so I'd love to be able to get out there and just actually see what it's like for myself and, you know, actually get to know more of my heritage.
Yeah, just to stand on the land there, that would be really kind of cool. I'm Scottish myself. I've never been to Scotland, but I always have this idea that I want to do that. So, you know, but as I get older, I need to make it happen.
Right. Time's going faster and faster.
It just doesn't seem to slow down at all. You're listening to Juno Afternoon. We're talking about the canoe journey landing with the Akwan next Tuesday out at Auk Rec. It's at 1 o'clock is when they expect the canoes to be landing. We're talking about public safety, making space for elders, and the parking for everyone else is to park over at the university, and then there's going to be an extra shuttle, so hopefully that'll speed things up as time goes through.
Yes.
And all of that. And so that's really awesome. Oh, and bring your own chair.
Bring your own chair.
Make sure you mention that again.
Bring some water because it looks like it's going to be nice.
It's going to be a nice day.
Yeah. If you have animals, probably leave them at home just because of how many people, unless they are like smaller,
very
people-friendly.
Yeah.
Just to because of the amount of people that will be out there. But yeah, even, you know, if our elders and our disabled attendees, if they can, we would prefer for them to utilize the UAS parking and the shuttle service. If they are able to, we will have very, very limited elder and disabled parking on site for those that can't. Preference is for everybody to park up at UAS.
That's cool. Alicia, what is your plans for celebration? What do you get to do that week?
After Tuesday, I get to take a nap.
I'm sure the planning is really overwhelming right now.
It's been a lot going into this.
Yeah.
It's my first time planning an event this large.
Oh, wow. Congratulations.
So, yeah, it's been an interesting challenge for me. I've really been enjoying it, though. I'm very thankful for some amazing coworkers. Absolutely could not do what I do without them beside me every day. Just phenomenal team that I get to work with within the public safety office specifically, but also just all of the Clinkett and Haida staff that I work with in general, just like I said, our procurement team, our communications team, our Office of the President team, are just all of the different offices that are all, you know, a part of this event. I can't do it on my own. It's definitely takes more than one person. So many hands make light work, and I've had a lot of hands helping me with this. So
that's
very appreciative.
So great. Well, I hope you get to make it to Grand Entrance and maybe some of the celebration dancing that'll be happening and all of the other events. We're going to be talking a lot about different events that are going on next week here on Juno Afternoon. Alicia Sell from Clinkett and Haida. Gunnath Cheesh for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me and letting us get this information out. I appreciate your help.
Yeah, and get out to the canoe landing on Tuesday, 1 o'clock out at Auk Rec. This is Juno Afternoon on KTOO. Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Emil Mackey at Country Financial, offering insurance for home, auto, and business, and life insurance to protect your family in case of death. Located in the Juno Nugget Mall. More information can be found online or by calling 907-500-7017. Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years. With cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juneau. More at heritagecoffee.com.
Sounds wild. Hi, I'm Riley Woodford for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. A snow machine hauls a sled across the wide open snow-covered tundra of western Alaska. A wildlife biologist is headed to a research site where he and his colleagues have been live trapping Alaska hares. The Alaska hare is found only in western Alaska. It's the giant cousin to the snowshoe hare, almost three times bigger. Some folks call Alaska hares tundra bunnies. Alaska hares favor open maritime tundra habitat and coastal lowlands, with alder thickets, sedge flats, and wet meadows. The meadows are not wet on this winter day. They're white, as are the Alaska hares. Like snowshoe hares in winter, they turn solid white with black-tipped ears, which are noticeably stubby and short compared to the ears of a snowshoe hare. This biologist has been catching Alaska hares, examining them, and equipping them with small tracking devices. Populations of Alaska hares have declined in recent years, and biologists are trying to better understand the status of the population, their movements, diet, and habitat use, and learn what might help. For Sounds Wild, I'm Riley Woodford.
You're listening to Juno Afternoon from Studio 2K at KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Our final guests today come from UAS and are part of the Outdoor Studies program, the English program. There are all kinds of programs that get together and do stuff out there. We're going to be talking about something, a really cool title. The alliteration is just off the charts here. Salmon, Sport, and Society. Plus some canoe trips, a capstone project, all kinds of stuff we've got going on. So instead of me saying it, let me just have you go down the line. Tell me your name and what you do out there at UAS, whether you're a professor or I know we have some students in here today too.
I'm Kevin Krein. I'm the director of the Outdoor Studies program. And so I teach courses in the Outdoor Studies program. And I'm also a professor of philosophy. So I teach philosophy courses and then some courses that mix the two, and in which we do philosophy that relates to outdoor activities and recreation.
Yeah, I think we talked about a little bit about that when you were on last time, the crossover of that, which I just think is amazing. So, okay, and you, sir?
I'm Robbie.
Okay.
I'm a environmental resources student, and I just wrapped up my third year at UAS.
Third year at UAS, okay.
And I'm Kevin Meyer. I teach English and environmental studies, and I'm part of the Salmon Sport and Society team here today with Robbie.
I love that.
It's nice to be back.
Hi, my name is Sage. I am a outdoor studies certificate student, and I recently just graduated with my Bachelor's of Arts in Psychology. So I'm back at UAS to do some more fun stuff.
Awesome. Okay. So who wants to tell me first about this Salmon Sport and Society? Is it a class? Is it a program? What exactly is that?
It's a class. It's a humanities class at UAS. I thought it was kind of like a class about the culture of fishing, like subsistence, sport fishing, and commercial fishing. And then it ended with a week-long sort of like service learning portion in Yakutat.
So more than you expected?
No, it's what I expected.
Okay,
I think it says it in the course description.
Okay. That's good. No surprises then. Okay, that's cool. And what was that experience like? How did it I guess first let's start there. What was it experience like taking that class?
It was super cool. I think I learned a lot, and I had a lot of fun. Engaging with the culture in Yakutat was super cool, or the community.
And you were what was the canoe part of this that you were doing?
The kayak? There's a kayak.
Oh, kayak.
Yeah, that's Kevin and Sage. Kevin Krein and Sage can tell you about kayaking.
Okay, yeah.
We did have briefly a potential canoe day, but it was very windy and cold in Yakutat, so canoeing in Yakutat.
So, but what were you doing there in Yakutat then?
So it's kind of the culmination of a semester-long look at the ways that people have either sustained or not sustained salmon across the globe, and then it narrows down to increasingly smaller views, and we end in Yakutat and think about the tensions between the various ways that people live with salmon now, and we classify those, as Robbie said, by commercial, sport, subsistence. But our actual project there is kind of a participant observation, but also we're there as guests of both the Forest Service and the Yakutat Tlingit tribe and the school, and we worked in the school as part of what they call Outdoor Safety Week. So UAS students were teaching 6th, 7th, and 8th, and then some high school kids various outdoor skills. And so
I see.
From 8 to 5, we were in the classroom.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. That's kind of cool. And Robbie, why this class? How is it going to relate to what you want to do?
Well, part of the class was fishing, and I'm pretty interested in fish and fishing. And that's kind of why I wanted to take the class at first. But I think it relates to what I want to do because I just thought it fit into my degree program fairly well. And
what is it you want to? What is it that you want to do after you graduate?
I'd like to work at NOAA or maybe Fishing Game.
Yeah, because I think aren't people like studying salmon and the populations and whether they're changing and sort of that kind of what this course is talking about too a little bit?
A little bit, yeah. We read a lot of literature about sort of historically and modern day the practices that have led to salmon declines across.
Yeah.
Europe and the United States, and how in Alaska we're managing them a little bit better, but it's also partially just because we started a little later. So
I see. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. But is it declining here? The teacher's looking at the student like, you
come on, Robbie, you've got this. It depends on who you ask.
What did he learn?
No, Robbie revealed a little bit of a bait and switch there. So there is some fly fishing, which is the Outdoor Cities link here. So we do fly fish for steelhead in the evenings when we're in Yakutat.
Okay.
And it's kind of how I sell the class. But in the end, it's more a full academic class that has this field component and a little bit of fishing. And I think I read my student evaluations today, and that would be the one critique, is that we didn't do enough fishing. We did too much academic stuff. So
the bait and switch wasn't quite exact all the way, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But the course, I mean, I think one way to think about it in terms of our whole program is that it's an excellent example of our courses and how really our goal is to blend academic coursework and thinking about kind of big questions and humans' relationship to the environment and things like that, and then blend those with actual time and experience outdoors doing really interesting and hopefully just kind of awesome stuff.
Yeah, that's kind of cool because I think when you were on last time, we were talking about what kinds of jobs or positions people would be taking this work into. Like there's a lot of people who want to work outside, and then we were talking about rangers, and we were talking about other kinds of environmental studies that people can do, and they get outdoors, and so all this experience sort of adds up to hopefully creating positions and people who are interested in continuing this work, right? Mm-hmm.
And this is an interesting. I'm going to switch to the other course.
Yeah, yeah.
But then we can come back to this one too. But Sage and I were just on a course in which we left from Juneau and kayaked over to Oliver Inlet on Admiralty, and then went across the little train tram, and then and then paddled down to Pack Creek bear viewing area. And what was awesome about it, I mean, not just the bears, we actually saw 16 brown bears on our trip, which was great, but it was cool to paddle up to Pack Creek and then find that two of our former students are currently rangers there working.
Oh, that's
and,
cool.
It was just really neat to be able to kind of have current students and see students who've graduated and gone on to, work and get really just amazing jobs and the kind of jobs they were kind of thinking about and wanting when they were students.
That's cool. Let's bring Sage into this. Can you describe this kayak trip?
Oh, man. Okay, so like started off with just two students, Victoria and Secret, and in one of our other classes, Mountain Studies, Kevin Krein singled me out on one of the ski lifts during our ski like time during the day, and he asked if I wanted to go on this expedition trip. And at the time, I was an exchange student from Iowa State, so I was like, sure, why not? Really had no idea what I was getting myself into. So basically, I learned how to sea kayak about 3 weeks before we went on this 8-day
expedition. So you had no kayak experience?
None at all. Absolutely none at all. Wow. But I was so down for the adventure. Okay. So that's how I ended up there. But I learned how to sea kayak with Glenn Wright, and he was amazing. And then we started preparing for our expedition. We camped for 8 days. As Kevin was saying, yeah, we went across the Gastineau Channel and the Seymour Canal and really put my kayaking skills to the test, because we got some pretty gnarly water the first day and like a couple of days in, like around Pack Creek as well. Yeah, we were just camping, hanging out, saw a lot of bears, whales, sea otters, or river otters, sea lions, seals, like all like super awesome
stuff. Wow. Did you ever, what do they call it when you capsize or something?
No one capsized, thankfully.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah, we all did really great.
Because that's, I mean, especially because you're new to it, like to have that experience and then have the rough waters and stuff, I would just be instantly out. I would be like rolled over and be like, I'll take the F. Thank you very much.
The trick is you just have to keep your mind absolutely in it. You cannot let yourself think about failure, because once you start thinking about failing, you're going to start leaning that way. And that's just really not an option when you're on the ocean.
Yeah, for sure. You got to keep it together, I guess. That's why I don't go on the ocean.
Right.
So did you say your degree is in psychology?
Yes.
Okay. So help me understand how this course and this experience might be helpful in your work that you're going to be doing.
Yeah. So as I previously mentioned, I got my Bachelor of Arts in Psychology recently. I graduated this last semester, and I'm hoping to bring the outdoors in. So I eventually want to get my PhD in clinical psychology to become a therapist of some kind. And I would really love to bring the outdoors into therapy. I think that connecting with the outdoors and having people understand that they are part of something greater than themselves and connect with nature is really healing to people, especially people who are extremely depressed or anxious or experiencing some type of PTSD. Reminding yourself that you're part of the natural world is really important. And I hope to bring the outdoors into my therapist office eventually.
That's really inspiring. I love the smile on the professor's face there. I'm thinking about that. No, because it is one of those things where you know, sometimes they do say if you're in a little bit of a stressful situation or you have some anxiety, take a walk. Take a walk around the block. Take a break from work. You know, go breathe for a little bit while you're walking. You know, we just had the Alicia from Tlingit and Haida on talking about the canoe landing, and just I've had so many experiences on this show of people talking about, you know, sort of connecting with the land, reconnecting with the land, you know, foraging on the land, being out in nature and just sort of being present. And I feel like it's even more important today than ever, because we're bombarded with so many things, you know, on our devices and just in our daily lives. We have so much more knowledge of what's going on in the world. So to sort of reconnect, but then figure out a way to integrate it into what you're doing. I think that's really inspiring, Sage. That's really kind of cool.
Thank you.
I like that. Is that what you love to hear, Kevin?
Oh, absolutely.
Especially, I know, because you're a philosopher. You have a doctorate in philosophy. But then I'm just curious, like, how did you as a doctor of philosophy get so involved in the outdoor studies program?
Well, I was born in Anchorage and grew up in Anchorage.
Okay.
And was always really, really attracted to skiing. And so had, you know, worked as a ski instructor and ski patroller and things as I was coming through school, and then got into ski mountaineering and doing that sort of thing. And when I took the job at UAS, it was a half-time job in philosophy. And this was 20-some years ago now. But I took the job and was amazed that UAS had no outdoor courses at all. And,
really?
Mentioned that in my interview. And then the next year we started offering a rock climbing class and a sea kayaking class and a backpacking class and a backcountry skiing class.
I love that. It's that thing where
just kind of grew. So
it's that thing where you mention something and they're like, hey, great, you can do it.
Exactly. That's exactly what happened.
You want to do it? Hey, take it on. That's kind of great. But it's been thriving for all these years.
Oh, yeah.
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 And you're seeing students out in the world. I love you saw your park ranger students out there and things like that.
Yeah. And I mean, it's gotten to the point now where internationally, too, when we go on different trips. Our students seem to be kind of working everywhere and, either in the guiding industry or other parts of the outdoor industry or then, and of course, many of them don't really want to do anything outdoors when they graduate or professionally at least. And so we have students who end up going to law school or graduate right. school or into just kind of other types of work. But it's really,
I mean. But Robbie, who might, you're going to maybe do some research or something, right? Work at NOAA, that kind of thing. But you'll still be out and about, right?
Yeah, that's what I'd be. Yeah. Love to do that, yeah.
Yeah. So what is your plan for next year? Do you plan to take a few more of these outdoor studies classes?
Yeah, that'd be great. I've enjoyed taking them before, and I'd like to take more of them. I do have some catch-up work to do with my degree, and I think I'll be here for another year and a half, but
I see.
Okay. I do plan to take more outdoor studies classes.
And are these courses that you're talking about, the Salmon, Sport and Society, and then this other class, Outdoor Studies Expedition, are these classes that will be offered again next year? Or how does that work, Kevin?
Yeah, so Kevin, I do the Salmon, Sport and Society class every other year.
Every other year, okay.
Yeah. Expedition happens every year, and we have a full slate of the kind of skills classes, but the more specialized upper division classes where we try and meld the academic work with the field time, we offer less frequently just because we need more students to be prepared to do them.
So, I see. Yeah. Okay. Right.
But then so next fall will be there are kind of three main courses that we do that are they're really these intensive field time with academic courses. So there's a course called Ocean Studies and a course called Mountain Studies and then Kevin's Salmon Sport and Society class. Mm. So in the fall we'll have a course called Ocean Studies that in which we look at different ways people relate to the ocean, but looking at literature and history and philosophy tied to ocean activities. And then we also have students out kayaking and things. So that'll be a fall course that's coming up, you know, really soon.
Are there courses like this in Anchorage?
Our program is, I think, unique in the sense that there are lots of places that have outdoor skills courses.
Yeah.
But these kinds of courses, I mean, when we were talking about starting the program, it had always been kind of my dream to be able to build courses like this. And one of the amazing things about coming to UAS was the fact that the administration really supported what we did. And in putting this together, we've had a lot of, and there are a lot of faculty members at UAS. So there's Kevin Meyer, who works as a fly fishing guide as well as an English professor, and Sage mentioned Glenn Wright, who is a political science professor, but then also is a pretty amazing sea kayaker. And we have, you know, different professors with different skills that have really been interested in being involved in the program.
That's so cool. I'm just jealous because when I went to UAA, I don't remember anything like these crossover classes like this to be able to incorporate into a degree, which I think is really cool. The best place to find out more information about all of this is on the UAS .alaska.edu website. Just put in outdoor studies on the search bar and you'll come up with the page for these courses. Get yourself involved. Kevin, Robbie, and Sage, Gunachish for being here today. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Gunachish.
Gunachish. Thank you.
Yeah.
There we go. That'll do it for this week's Juno Afternoon. Join us next week for a bunch of celebration coverage right here on Juno Afternoon every day at 3 p.m. Juno Afternoon airs Wednesday through Friday right here on KTO Juno 104.3 and KAUK Juno Auk Bay 91.7 where UAS is. Hello, out the road. Find the show online at ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon where you can listen to episodes, subscribe to the podcast, or find out how to be a guest on the show. Livestream archives are available over on our YouTube page. Our theme music is by Indian Agent. I'm Boston Christopher, producer and host of the program, with help today from Aaron Tripp. Gunath Cheesh, have a fantastic Thursday.
Listening to KTOO 104.3 Juno and KAUK 91.7 Juno, Auk Bay.